interrupting the current neo-Uranial, climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM585. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed. And you don't know what you missed until you get behind the woodshed. Here we go, because life being more than a spectator sport, something that must have been freely spreading and shedding for eons. This is fascinating stuff right here that passed through here a couple weeks ago. Move it to the top of the list. Really interesting stuff. DNA fragments all over the world. Nobody really noticed about it. One woman, scientist, observant, started noticing something. Out of sight, dark fungi. Fun guy. Run the world from the shadows. The land, water, and air around us are chock full of DNA fragments from fungi that mycologists can't link to known organisms. These slippery beings are so widespread, scientists are calling them dark fungi. It's a comparison to the equally elusive dark matter and dark energy that permeate the universe. Like those invisible entities, dark fungi are hidden movers and shakers, prime examples of what E.O. Wilson calls the little things that run the world, although these are more tangible than dark matter, I would say. If you want to discover a hidden world and new life forms, you don't have to scour dark caves or slog through remote rainforests. Just look under your feet. When the graduate student Anna Roslin went to the northern Sweden to map the distribution of particular root-loving fungus, she found something much more intriguing. Many of her root samples contained traces of DNA from unknown species. Weirder still, she never encountered a complete organism. When the field season ended, she had only isolated bits of raw genetic material. The fragments clearly belonged to a fungal world, kingdom, but they revealed little else. Quote, "I got obsessed," recalls Roslin, now a professor of evolutionary biology at Uppsala University in Sweden. Since then, mycologists have realized that such phantoms are everywhere. Point to a patch of dirt, a body of water, even the air you're breathing, and odds are that it is teeming with mushrooms, molds, yeasts, or their spores, which no one has ever seen. In ocean trenches, Tibetan glaciers, and all habitats between, researchers are routinely detecting DNA from obscure fungi. By sequencing the snippets, they can tell they're dealing with new species, thousands of them, that are genetically distinct from any known to science. They just can't match the DNA to tangible organisms growing out of in the world. So you can read more at the link. Really, really interesting stuff right there. Just kind of contemplate what's going on about all that. For a long time, these organisms will be making essentially protein strings. And so some of these things that came to mind are that these DNA fragments are sloughs that didn't meet adaptation purposes or failed to fulfill a proper purpose, but maybe even a detrimental one, and was rejected by whatever the organism one that did start to make it. Or possibly these DNA fragments are available for assimilation, for adaptation in other species as well, if the need arises, or something else on top of that. Maybe Mother Nature is just a life-providing DNA-making overachiever. And all I can say from now then is that the fungus is among us. And then it wants to turn into a brain and get itself a body, because even a robot knows getting behind a woodshed requires mind, body, and spirit. Having a mind, even a fungus among us, has spirit enough to begin perfecting the use of its body, likely built by a fungus-directed brain of a lab technician. As we can read, robot with human brain tissue learns how to use arms. Brain-on-chip exhibited basic human intelligence, researchers say. Human stem cells form a brain organoid that was wired to the robot built by researchers at Nanjing University and Southern University of Science and Technology in China. The brain-on-chip was able to learn basic tasks such as moving its limbs, avoiding obstacles, and grasping objects, according to the researchers, while exhibiting some intelligence functions of a biological brain. And I've mentioned these organoids before. Quite fascinating. These stem cells are pretty interesting. Talk about the bits of DNA and protein strings that come together to make something. These are them right here. Just interesting, generally. The brain-computer interface on a chip is a technology that uses an in vitro cultured brain, in quotes, such as a brain organoids, coupled with an electrode chip to achieve information interaction with the outside world through encoding and decoding a stimulation feedback, said Ming Dong, an executive director of the Haihe Laboratory for Brain-Computer Interaction and Human-Computer Integration at Tianjin University. In order to function, the brain organoids have similarly needs to the human brain, including fluid, nutrient lines, temperature control, and a protective casing. The latest breakthrough comes just days after the scientists in Japan revealed that they had grafted living human skin onto the face of a humanoid robot in an effort to give it a more lifelike appearance. See, even something here, an organoid brain is too intelligent to do, though, is to buy ammo from an AI-powered vending machine selling bullets at two grocery stores in Alabama, selling gun ammunition and artificial intelligence-powered retail kiosks that to scan buyers' identification cards and faces before spitting out bullets. The refrigerator-sized machines located at Fresh Value stores in Tuscaloosa and Pell City use 360-degree facial recognition to verify a customer's age and ID in order to make it easier for folks to get firearm ammo. And much easier to build a dossier on the enemy extremist, I would think. The vending machines are legal and approved by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. Tuscaloosa Police Chief Brent Blankley told the Tuscaloosa Thread. These names always get me. Shooting Blankley. And I bet Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco Firearms once said that it's just so easy, folks. Just so easy to get all this biometrics. They are then prompted, these folks that want to do this, to verify that, but an organoid brain won't do this, I can tell you. Won't move its arms to push the button. It knows what's going on. There, the buyer's prompted to verify that they're over 18 with a government-issued identification card. The device then scans the customer's face and requests payment before dispensing the ammunition. And you'll do that, too, you folks. All of you out there not thinking a thing about that. Facial recognition to get your ammo. Ammo vending machines, a big hit in Alabama grocery stores. Another story I found. Could not believe I was actually reading this. The company American Rounds has actually installed their automatic ammunition vending machines in 6 grocery stores, 4 in Oklahoma and 2 in Alabama, where the machines have drawn the interest of local media and local politicians in places like Tuscaloosa. The reaction to the machines has mostly been positive. Quote, customers think it's a good idea. They think it's a convenient. They like the fact that it's here, Slunger said. Sales have been steady and strong at all the locations we've launched so far, and hopefully it just continues that trend. So convenient, folks, for the day to entice you into the digital trap. Didn't even need a WorldCoin. Just a bit of lead to get you in. Making it so convenient to give up the anonymity of people that need to be a free people. This is such a disgrace in my mind, what's going on. Do people realize the behavioral control, the programming going on just in this little process? Even the mere desensitization to the system and the technology? Clearly, they don't. They absolutely cannot fathom what's going on here. Next year, token citizenship created by the biometrics are already in the government hands, both local and federal, is sold to third parties on top of this and tied to your sustainable obligations or to enforce those red flag laws. It's so easy and convenient for them, folks. And that's how easy it is to transform a country into a Siberian gulag here. And we just read this little simple story, using the Second Amendment to do it to you. Well, you don't need no stinking Second Amendment in this gulag, do you? No prison. The guards do. Even the organoid brain knows better than to do that, and it doesn't even have a face, folks. Unless we, the people, become more intelligent here, I think, as I think through this, more intelligent than an organoid brain tissue mass. This society is pate on toast, it seems to me. Especially if we, the people, do not have enough brain matter to have command of the language, while a few take advantage of the innocent. in this report absurd isn't strong enough at all in discussing this. As we revisit a bit here, the Supreme Court just downgraded the insurrection to trespassing. I say these things because I'm not sure people appreciate, men and women have been in jail for 4 years on what was a trespassing charge in inhumane conditions. That's democracy, folks. The Supreme Court's decision on Friday in Fisher v. U.S. struck down one of the most common charges against January 6th defendants, quote, obstruction of an official proceeding, close quote. It had been used in hundreds of cases, and those convictions are now invalid. But the biggest impact on the decision may occur elsewhere. For years, calling January 6th an insurrection has been a litmus test for press, pundits, and politicians. Members of the Congress, such as Eric Swalwell, claimed a conspiracy of armed and organized insurrectionists. The claim is legally absurd, but politically advantageous. It now seems the insurrection increasingly looks more like a legal case of mass trespass and unlawful entry. So we can go through, like I said, I just touched these things. There's so much to discuss on how wrong all of this was. The DOJ violated its trust and didn't seek justice, but something else. It's written right in this story here, what the DOJ was seeking. This last week's decision shows that the Justice Department was wrongly prosecuting hundreds of people for the obstruction crime. It was all of what Justice Department official Michael Sherwin proudly declared in a TV interview that, quote, our office wanted to ensure that there was a shock and awe. It worked because we saw through media posts that people were afraid to come back to D.C. because they're like, if we go there, we're going to get charged. We wanted to take out those individuals that essentially were thumbing their noses at the public for what they did. I understand public means government here, not you. And lives have been irreparably destroyed because of that lawlessness, which then took years to be exposed. Now consider maybe if it hadn't been exposed. That's what these government tyrants count on, and why it's so important to have at least the press, at least people that are independent of, non-dependent, I guess, on the government to feed it information, people who are really researching. Years and years in inhumane isolation in prisons for a trespass charge. And I think about that. I'm going to get too far off of that. I'm going to move on here quickly, but it seemed to me the video proved that the cops were inviting them in. It wasn't a trespass after they were being invited in and went down the lanes and the carpets and inside of that. All that time didn't seem to be much of a trespass whatsoever. And how, in fact, are you trespassing the house of the people? Anyway, lots of stuff. Lots of injustice going on there. You hear what the government works on, though. Shock and awe. And another recent case that will placate anyone looking only skin deep as I was reading this. Not a subject matter I follow because of what I've learned about this condition, and if you will, they've lost me to all this, and I'm not that interested. I don't put too much time in it, but it's important. It's important at least to keep track and to show people if you can. I use it as a tool of education more than anything else. I hope that people pick that up behind the woodshed. The Supreme Court gets it right in Section 2. The Supreme Court's decision in Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee is not only the correct result under the applicable law, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, it is a common-sense decision that upholds the traditional state voting rules that Section 2 has never meant to reach. The court upheld Arizona's ban on vote trafficking, parenthetically, or what is euphemistically referred to as vote harvesting, and the state's requirement that an individual vote within his assigned precinct for his ballot to count. The importance of this case in the field of voting law and in the midst of a fierce contentious fight over election reform laws implemented by the states cannot be overemphasized enough. Ever since the seminal case of Thornburg versus Gingles in 1986, where the court laid out the test, the Gingles factors, for determining a violation of Section 2 after it was amended by Congress in 1982, all of the cases that have come before the court have involved redistricting or vote dilution claims. That's, I think, would be considered all gerrymandering considerations. Brnovich was the first case, as Justice Samuel Alito writes in the major opinion which considers how to apply a Section 2 challenge to state laws governing the time, place, or manner of an election, to wit, quote, how ballots are collected and counted. Such cases are proliferated in the lower courts. They have proliferated in the lower courts, but none have reached the Supreme Court before this one. The majority has it right when it comes to how Section 2 should be applied in these types of cases. It will remain an effective tool to stop actual racial discrimination in the voting context, but it will not be what critics of this decision would like, a partisan tool that can be used to stop public policy decisions with which they disagree on how individuals register and vote in a particular state. And I'll leave the extensive analysis in the article to the listener to further qualify yourself. As I said, I'm bringing this from a site that I criticized last week to not really get it correctly done. This one wasn't quite so bad, but I'm not as interested in this. Some of you really are. I think it's important. I've just not been confident in that system to put more energy to it. And I've had to figure out other ways for how I would deal with that myself. I've explained them on the broadcast. So qualify what you read here. It goes through quite four or five different things that the court did, which I think is important to watch if you don't have time to go through and analyze it for yourself. So if you're so inclined, please get the link at the Blogcaster or any of the syndication channels on the numerous video play forms that we're on. And one thing I do want to respond to outside of any analysis there, but from the consequential perspective, is the final point that he writes here. Finally, the strength of the state's interests served by a challenging voting rule is also an important factor that must be taken into account, says the court. No doubt, to the dismay of the opponents of election reforms, the court held that the strong and entirely legitimate state interest in the prevention of fraud, because it can change the outcome of a close election, dilute the votes of eligible citizens, and undermine public confidence in the fairness of elections and the perceived legitimacy of the announced outcome, is what's important. What is most important about this is that the states don't have to show evidence of past fraud to justify legislative actions intended to prevent a future fraud. And I believe that statement is valid. But that isn't my contention. Because, number one, the state has undermined my confidence in the fairness of elections and the perceived legitimacy of the announced outcome. I no longer participate for that reason. Number two, that caused me to relook at those voting rights at the time I started to see that. The power to stop fraud the Supreme Court rightfully retains in the state in this decision is undermined by the fraud that the state perpetrates in not fully disclosing the status required to vote and its relevance to a foreign power, in this case, the federal government. With all the five-star chef-rated Caesar's word salad that covert fraud is smothered in by this decision, if you look at the surface, it's covered over by this decision, the supreme seasoning. And in the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, problem, action, solution vein, the Pavlovian response to what the court identifies as not actual but merely perceived legitimacy, these people that are partisan promote this, they step in and based on the perceived but misplaced injustice, they sense, they perpetrate and advance the covert overthrow and fraud, such as insisting upon IDs and other forms of subservient resident or commerce status, which is also federally fiscally tapped to the associated taxpayer to support in the voter campaign, such as you'll hear maybe read, I won't talk about it, but I just noticed that those same funds are denied to Jill Stein, these residents of which are locally subject to a Model Business Corporation Act usurping a commerce state on top of it all, which substitutes the permanent laws of the people and then imposes and implements that democratically derived consent of the governed minority decision contrary to the general obligation to keep in the republic. And I've talked about all this in other ways, in lots of different ways. I just put it together here of what goes on when the court addresses these mechanical things and we miss the point underneath it, which is you're living in an occupied and usurped state. And it's written right in the documentation, the so-called code and laws, but no one seems to pay attention to it. And the courts will never get to that. And that's my problem with all this voter talk. Well, it's one problem. But anyway, does anyone else know of this fraud? The consequence of this usurpation? And if you have a study for that, then you'll should be clear what I'm saying. If not, you need to start to study for it. And then once you see that, you can see, as I do, as I'm talking, why I'm talking about it, you can see how easy it is for the master race running this joint to run the voting scam on people. Like they're some corporate shareholder. Because maybe they are. And how can anyone maintain any confidence in a system like this once you see it? But you have to be able to see it. Well, sure, you'll agree with it because of ignorance. And ignorance that they used against the people throwing them under the bus a long time ago. But they'll Trump, 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 Biden, Biden, oh wait, replace Biden we go. Even if everything I said is wrong here, if I look at this and just kind of, okay, let's throw all that, what I just said out. Forget all that research I did. Forget, I misread everything. Hadn't anyone noticed relative to the federal presidency or the vice presidency, no one votes for those offices. Voting is not an election. An election is performed by electors, not voters. Your Trump, Trump, Biden, whomever vote means nothing. Now we can prove that because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but Trump won the election of the political party and usurpers derived electors. Go back and look at that. I did. I wanted to make sure that I was seeing that right. Fascinating, the things that they tell us right up front. We just ignore that. So let's go back to the point here. As long as the usurping occupiers can maintain the mere perception of legitimacy, they have those people captured that believe that. The vote means nothing, but people perceive their vote is legitimate. And that is all that matters. And the Supreme Court just confirmed that. Isn't that amazing what you find in these news reports? Well, not too amazing. It's actually what's going on. The vote doesn't have to be lawful. The rules for voting are required to protect the public perception of legitimacy to the state's interest, if you'll read very carefully. That's what I said in the beginning, too. State's interest. Do you think these states are still organic establishment? I just explained they weren't. I've explained how and why. I just mentioned it, but I explained how and why years back. Periodically, I'll bring it back up. The rules for voting are required to protect the public perception of legitimacy, to keep the natives from focusing and then ousting the occupiers running this whole scam. And that's international. You don't have to have the right to alter or abolish government. That's given to all people that are overcome by a maladministration. But we have it written, so that I don't know why the excuse that we're not considering how to use it. So until there is a fundamental shift of the confidence-killing perception allowing for the identification of the corrupted state and its extent and its corrupted state interest, all I can say is vote harder. And those controlling the state-appointed electors through the same perception-controlled system of the overthrown states in the Electoral College will laugh at you. Moreover, any voting or electing does not speak to those no longer having any perception the voting or elector system are legitimate, or that they meet the chosen restricted status in the corrupted state, which makes up the bulk of the population in a territory that's said to be voted, which is a minority. And those no longer having a perception the voting or elector system are legitimate are not presumed a no vote or of no confidence either for purposes of limited government. But people are allowed to entertain themselves and the states are confirmed here to offer easy access to do so. Just as the Supreme Court decision identifies saying, quote, Arizona law generally makes it very easy to vote because perception. Not reality in the Lincolnized post-founding father era of America. Because timely reality checks can bite, speaking of Hitlery, and never forget Benghazi. Right, Gariel? Thank you for listening in, too, and noticing the last time I mentioned. Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign aligned to Super PAC violated federal election law rules, court says. We can put the date back out there for you, 2016. We're finally getting around to it. That's what caught my eye here. The Clinton campaign and the Super PAC incorrectly used an internet exemption to set up the Benghazi hearing war room to respond to critics during the campaign, but did not report it as a campaign expense, according to the court. Well, I wish they'd get on them, on her, on about that Benghazi, but no, no, no. Well, it's about an internet exemption. It was wrong. Anyway, this is important, too. For those of you that have faith in the system, think you're getting the information you need to be a wise elector or constituent, this is finally coming out. We hold that the commission acted contrary to law in dismissing the complaint because we conclude that the internet exemption cannot be read to exempt from disclosure those expenditures that are only tangentially related to an eventual internet message or post. The commission's reading of the internet exemption stretches it beyond the lawful limits, the court said. I just want to know, where was the government to check this that we had to wait till now, since 2016, to find that out? Now, how are people to maintain confidence in a political system that can't keep the constituent timely and fairly apprised of wrongdoing? How is that possible? On top of all this other stuff, I mean, and some of the stuff I don't even talk about. I'll never get to the things I ever thought I was going to do when I started this broadcast. There's just so much ignorance and so few people that are digging in to bring ourselves up, pull ourselves up by the bootstraps in order to make just a basic understanding of really how this is all put together, whether we can really fully gather how that was. It's quite the intertwined rat's nest, essentially. But running through here, the last court case, now we see, you know, years later, justice is slow. Justice, and this sorts of delays are injustice. I don't care. You may finally find out, but it was injustice at the time. There should be, like as I said, when actions are being taken and there's laws against it, there should be a judicial check and balance, jealously guarding the law, jealously guarding the rights of the republic, the trust established by the judiciary. They should be the upfront gatekeepers, not the ones that pilfer through. As you heard in the Arizona case, oh, there's hundreds of these cases that come, and this is the first one that gets reviewed. It's not justice. But running through all this, through the due process failures, and how lawful due process brings a better justice, if we can just even get the judges and the attorneys just to follow the rules. Something lawful due process may not be able to curtail is the private surveillance which pervades our societies to curtail our right to be left alone, not tracked, traced, or trafficked ourselves. We also point on the little kids about being trafficked. We don't realize that we've been trafficked as people, adults. We think we are sovereign. We think we have a say. No, we're being trafficked. I just said this place is wired like a commerce system. The Model Business Corporation Act, it's not a joke. And I have explained how they put it in, how they made it look like it was right, and how they hid it. And then Craig read it on air in an article that you could have found. It's not longer available, apparently. So the information's out there. This is not even new information. But anyway, I told you about the third-party problem. The government learned that it could rely on third party without not having to get a warrant. Now they're working together. Private, public, private partnership. It's fascism. And then you don't have to go very far to figure that out. A lot of people will make a big deal about that. Nope, it's just fascism. FedEx's secretive police force is helping cops build an AI car surveillance network. And I'll bet that organized braid paid attention to this. And we'll see in the future what happens with its arms and legs. The role of your FedEx driver is aiding police surveillance on you. The FedEx is using AI-powered cameras installed on its trucks to help aid police investigations, a new report has revealed. The popular postal firm has, you know, that was an interesting statement. Postal firm? I never considered that they were a postal firm. Parcel firm, maybe? Postal? No, I didn't. But look at that. The postal firm has partnered with a $4 billion surveillance startup based in Georgia called Flock Safety, Forbes reported. Flock specializes in automated license plate recognition and surveillance and already has a fleet of around 40,000 cameras spanning 4,000 cities across 40 states. Flock Safety cameras are used to track vehicles by their license plate as well as the make, model, and color of their cars. Other identifying characteristics are also monitored, such as dents and even bumper stickers. Lisa Femia, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, warned that FedEx's participation could prove problematic because private firms are not subject to the same transparency laws as cops. FedEx has teamed up with the company to monitor its facilities across the U.S., but under the deal, it's also sharing its flock surveillance feeds with law enforcement. And it is believed to be one of four multi-billion dollar private companies with this arrangement. It's led critics to liken the move to rolling out a mass surveillance network, as it emerged from some local police forces also are sharing their flock feeds with FedEx. FedEx is using AI-powered cameras installed on its trucks to help aid police investigations, a new report has revealed. Jay Stanley, a policy analyst with the ACLU, told the Virginia Pilot, quote, "There's a simple principle that we've always had in this country, which is that government doesn't get to watch everybody all the time just in case somebody commits a crime. The United States is not China," he continued, "but these cameras are being deployed with such density that it's like GPS tracking everyone." The United States is not China. It's not. But it could act just like it, couldn't it? Sounds like it is. You know it when you see it. In response to Forbes' report, it's a small world after all. We're all sustainably developed. In response to Forbes' report that FedEx was a part of Flock's system, he told the outlet, "It raises the questions about why private company would have privileged access to data that normally is only available to law enforcement. This," she told Forbes, "could leave the public in the dark while at the same time expanding a sort of mass surveillance network. Flock uses real-time data to enable and incentivize safe driving," a description on its website says. So I suppose it's not too far-fetched that incentivize will soon, if not already, mean revenue, fines and fees, enjoying your civil rights to exactions of every kind and no other enjoyment. 42 U.S.C. 1981, for those that want to be interested in go reading the law, see what your equal rights are. And this then will be behavioral programming, again, sustainably, of course, with hunter-killer instincts. The Shelby County Sheriff's Office in Tennessee confirmed its partnership with Flock in an email to Forbes. "We share reads from our Flock license plate readers with FedEx in the same manner we share the data with other law enforcement agencies, locally, regionally, and nationally," Public Information Officer John Morris told the outlet. He also confirmed these departments had access to FedEx's Flock feeds. In participation of being unmasked after Forbes found the name of the force on a publicly available list of data-sharing partners, along with others such as the Pittsburgh Police Department in Indiana, located just outside of Indianapolis, it's also confirming the database is national from a hub of sustainable corruption in Tennessee. But look at how well they're wrapped up into this. For now, it's currently unclear just how far-reaching the partnership between law enforcement and FedEx actually is, or how much Flock data is being shared. Forbes also found that FedEx was not alone in its decision to sign up with Kaiser Permanente, the largest health insurer carrier in the United States, also taking part. Are you listening, folks? Are you listening to the integration on the public-private partnership side of this and AI? Meanwhile, police forces around the world over the past few years continue to pick up Flock as a partner, with more than 1,800 law enforcement agencies taking part. Overall, more than 3,000 American communities using Flock technology only 10 years since the startup surfaced in 2014. Now, there's more to read and more to see in the videos at the link. The Siberian Gulag is built back better real quickly here, if you haven't noticed, securely securing security for the they. And all I can say is it's time to get the Flock out of here. It seems to me. On the theme of surveillance, and globally so, Bavarian court enables German counterintelligence to monitor AFD in Bavaria. You think it's over there? Be careful. These are political parties. The government comes in and scrutinizes you if they don't like what you have to say. Well, maybe they don't give you the funds like just happened to Jill Stein. And I'm not promoting Jill Stein. I'm just telling you that's the system. That's what's going on. And we see it kind of global, like everything. The Munich Administrative Court has rejected the claim of the Alternative for Germany AfD party against the Bavarian Office for the Protection of the Constitution, which suspected the party of right-wing extremism, enabling the agency to continue monitoring the AfD, media reported on Monday, citing the court ruling. In May, a higher administrative court in the western German state of North Rhine-Westphalia ruled that the federal agency's decision to classify the party as suspected of right-wing extremism was justified. Earlier in June, AfD member Eugene Schmidt told Sputnik that the attempt to ban the party was an anti-democratic procedure that revealed that the political establishment in Germany was overwhelmed and threatened by the party's success in 2024 European Parliament elections. German lawmaker Marco Wanderwitz said in June that he had convinced enough members of German Parliament to submit a motion to ban the AfD over alleged ties to far-right extremism. If the Bundestag approves the motion, the potential banning of the AfD would then have to be considered by the Federal Constitutional Court. So let me understand something as we read through that part. The people have increasingly voted for a political group the establishment and the courts have determined is extremist. So that makes all those in support of that political group opposing the current regime extremists. That means to me to be undemocratic on its face, you'd think. Don't it? Well, unless you know what democracy means. The establishment declaring an increasing part of the population extreme to the position of the controlling regime and banishing their representation, in other words, that the current regime is not serving an increasing number of German population, and these extremist designation is the political, not judicial, takedown effort contrary to the will of those people, suggesting strongly the current regime doesn't give a fig for what the population thinks, and will use lawfare to silence the people, to secure its increasingly unsupported entrenchment against the will of its people. Is that about right? Sounds like a bit like here we got America going on over there, don't it? How did all these countries learn to do this at the same time? Aren't you glad you live in a constitutional republic constrained by law instead of a democracy? As we read this next thing on that point. The consequence of these tyrants getting away with it. They just keep rolling. They don't stop. You'll have to stop them. German court finds far-right AfD pursues goals against democracy. To my mind, that'd be great in America because we don't live in a democracy. Go ahead. Be against democracy. Go away. But anyway, no one understands that. No, they think they go vote harder. That's what they go do. A German high court on Monday ruled the domestic security services could continue to treat the far-right Alternative for Germany as a potentially extremist party, meaning they retain the right to keep it under surveillance. Like FedEx? Maybe? The Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, BFV, charged with protecting Germany's democratic order from extremist threats, has classified the AfD as potentially extreme since 2021. Judges at the High Administrative Court in Munster, I found that interesting, don't know anything about German courts and law, but administrative court, their democracy is administrative. It's not like rights to me, but it looks like it's not. The administrative court in Munster upheld the lower court's 2022 finding that the designation was proportionate and did not violate the Constitution or European or domestic civil law. That sounds like an occupying force right there. When they make that comparison. Anyway, I didn't look for that. I just noticed that as I read that through for you. The court finds that this is sufficient evidence that AfD pursues goals to run against the human dignity of certain groups and against democracy, the judge wrote. There are grounds to suspect at least part of the party wants to accord second-rank status to German citizens with a migration background. That is a statement of sustainability. But through an administrative court, no less. That's very interesting to me. Certainly says there's a difference. And then after that was confirmed, this happens to those folks in that group. Remember, this is an increasingly popular political group. The population is on their side. And the court comes out against them. They're extremists. German court prohibits AfD members from owning guns. An administrative court in Dusseldorf has ruled that the members of the anti-globalist, anti-migration Alternative for Deutschland party cannot hold gun licenses and own firearms due to a perceived risk to national security, like the perceived legitimacy of your vote. I hope you folks are, everyone's listening to this. This is how it's done against us. It's what you feel and what you believe, and just what sustainability plays on. Not what is, not reality, not based on foundation. Psychological warfare. And you're in all this, there's your national security immunity license to commit tyranny in that last statement as well. Gun ownership in Germany is already heavily regulated under strict licensing laws with exemptions primarily for hunting or competitive shooting. So, heavily regulated, not for altering or abolishing the government either. Have you registered your gun or the right to carry in your democracy lately, folks? According to the court's verdict, all or members of the dissident parties under the investigation by the country's federal office for the protection of the Constitution are considered unreliable under firearm laws and therefore banned from possessing guns. The case was originally brought by two AFD members who claimed that revoking their gun licenses was a violation of their constitutional rights. And it went against them. Anybody say red flag law, folks? So their constitutional rights, they thought they violated the constitutional rights. Well, apparently not violated in a democracy. That's all I can say when I read that. And I hope you did too. There is a distinction to be made, and I think it's a big failure for us not to make it. And the system that's working, they all tell you they're working in the democracy. No one steps back and says, wait a minute, that's not where I'm at. I'm not there. No, you go Trump, 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 Biden, Biden, whatever, whomever they're going to throw in there. The military-industrial complex isn't the only one vying for your bodies, however. They need slave-master relation productivity to work people to death building their bombs. As we read, EU nations adopts six-day work week. Greece is trying to tackle shrinking productivity amid an exodus of skilled workers. The Greek government has allowed more businesses to impose a six-day working week on their employees in a bid to bolster this country's struggling economy. The public interest folks. Greece is the first member of the European Union to introduce the measure. Quote, the core of this legislation is worker-friendly, deeply growth-oriented, Mitsotakis has said after the Greek parliament approved the law several months ago. It's worker-friendly, folks. It's growth-oriented. I don't know how these people are going to grow anymore. But anyway, it's growth-oriented. Productivity. What was that about attacking the productivity? And then the people are the human capital. And I've talked about those education benchmarks in the United States and all the states. They're sitting there, just like this, right here. So don't think I'm talking over there. This is just in the news today to remind us of what's happening to us and what has happened. Productivity has been among the biggest issues for the Greek economy since it plunged into steep recession following the debt crisis of 2009. Remember, these are the same people that talk about in the EU about the universal income. You work, you get money for not doing it. Okay. Notwithstanding all that, data tracked by the European Commission shows the nominal labor productivity per working hour in Greece is nearly 40% lower than the EU average. So give them more hours per week for employees to be 40% less productive and pay them more. As we can read, under the extended work weeks, employees in certain industries and manufacturing facilities have the right to choose between working. They have a right to choose more hours and longer time. An additional 2 hours a day or an extra 8-hour shift. Employees will receive 40% extra pay for their sixth working day and 115% more if they work on Sundays and holidays. So 40% less work for 40% more pay. Well, that'll stimulate the economy. Sustainably working the old cud-chewing natural gas-producing anthropomorphs to death as well. The measure is expected to help the government combat steadily declining productivity related to a shrinking population and a shortage of skilled workers. Fascinating, the inverse logic they used to hunt us down and kill us in everything we need in our lives. As I've explained the BRICS will be Haiti's bent here to impose sustainable development, as that last story touches on. If you ever you just read the words, you see that it's sitting right in there. Greece is greasing the skids on that one to get it go quicker. But to impose here, the BRICS is going to impose the sustainable development on their emerging economic parity that's needing to have across the globe. This article artificially claims a contention with the West when there is none. And I'd like to analyze that for that part. When they do that, it legitimizes the UN usurpation and makes it seem that the U.S. is somehow falling short in all of this. But in fact, the U.S. EPA is a foreign pillar of that usurpacious agenda within our own borders. And it's another reason why removing an agency deference there, I was talking about last week in those cases, is so important in taking away the administrative weapons destroying our country. Again, in productivity, see, the EPA goes after productivity. There is a connection to all this. You think maybe not, but I'm bringing it all together in all these little subject matter areas that tie it all together. And I do that in every broadcast. And it may take a while for you to listen through to hear that. You can't come in a few seconds and then leave. You can't even 10 minutes. You may hear some interesting stuff. Maybe you don't hear anything interesting. I don't know. But what I pulled together is tab by tab, episode by episode, episodes by episodes, as I'm attempting to try and show people what we're up against. And it's a global thing. And we only find interest in ourselves, but I try to show it's over there too, so that we can see we're actually together in this, but we're really not together. And we know that because the United States laws are distinct in some very important ways, which I wholeheartedly agree with. But they're production oriented, and the, as I've been saying, the bankers, the those that run the place, have to get control of production. And so you're hearing it in the human capital. They're going to work you to death a little bit more in Greece. They're going to try it. They're going to start it. But here, no country needs a UN agenda to run their place. They need to conserve resources where they can also not pollute their land. And this is the conflation of sustainable development, where they used pollution from the 70s, as I was telling you about. And then they switched over to all natural processes and made those human or human-related harms. Sustainable development, or the ESGs, has nothing to do with things known time immemorial, as you'll hear admitted here when I get to this article here, then ignored by the article in favor of foreign contrivance that's bent on the global enslavement by at least the moneyed interests, as I've been mentioning here through this last part. And we read here, is how Russia and India counter West's hypocrisy on the climate agenda. Again, this is a false setup. They're all doing it. But if I point to the other guy and think he's doing bad and you think I'm doing good, you forget that what we're doing is what's wrong, not who's doing bad or bad, the relative good or bad. It's what we're doing that you're going to miss. We slip it underneath your radar, so to speak. While the environment was never previously a priority in ties, today's Moscow and New Delhi are focused on developing innovations for emerging markets. Again, this vocabulary tells you where we're going already. When trying to impose restrictions against Russia, companies working in India, New Delhi, Western partners, are undermining India's interests. This is particularly noteworthy regarding the unfolding of Indo-Russia-Russian cooperation on issues related to sustainable development, the ESG, environmental, social, and governance, not government, governance agenda. It's strictly got to be inside administrative rule, like you hear already German, the Germans are already used to it. And combating climate change. And another, countries that can literally help the world avoid climate disaster in the coming years if their economies rise along the green path. The green path is the green religion. This Indian regime runs the stalking horse of environmentalism under the cover of the already internally held intention that is said here, the Indian people have always strived for harmony in nature. And so they're going to exploit that. Some nature in those in people is what they exploit. The Indian people then do not need sustainable development if that is all about being in harmony with nature, do they then? But as climate change is not about the weather, it's whether the sustainable development is going to transform your nation. It's not about the environment either, because that's the stalking horse. We'd have to question why it's even viable if the people already is in their nature to do that. More in that being in harmony. That's also part of the sustainable language. So unless the political environment is controlled by the global financial ecosystem, the token citizens will also be controlled by it. And this is what they're pressing for. And we look where both Russia and India are in this regard. And they're far beyond any contrivances mentioned in the article. When you go read this article, they just build up all these contrivances about why they need to do it. The countries are already way past that. That's just for our consumption. As we read here, importantly, Russia and India share a common approach to international climate change efforts. It's been there a while. They know it's consistent, their common approach. Both countries stress the historical responsibility of developed nations for global environmental deterioration and climate change. Notice the always the conjunctive climate change. So these nations actually are not sovereign enough to clean up their own house, that they need to resort to a UN fraud wrapped in an enigma advancing global Siberian gulag dependency and slavery? Is that what we're trying to hear? What's going on here? Is that what they want us to believe? Really? How do you folks in those countries put up with this deception like that? If Indian people are in harmony with nature, why do we need the UN? Just as taxes have nothing to do with stopping the natural creation of natural gas, what does a Siberian panopticon have to, anything to do with keeping the local environment as wholesome as productively and as productively as possible? Did you get that? Natural creation of natural gas? Why it's called natural gas? And speaking to those in government taxation, implying potential eradication, you tax something natural? Why? How? What are you planning to eradicate being the related source nuisance for the need of the tax? Answer? It's you, my dear listener. You. You are to be eradicated when you are not profitable to the they and the invented obligation to Gaia. Given its anthropomorphic cause for all that is wrong with the world, maybe it is that the ESG's meaning, eradicate sources, goals. Are you the source? And I don't believe I just asked a question, actually, there. Eradicate sources, goals. Sustainable goals. Sustainable development goals. You're the cause. Everything they do is to take something away from you. And it's global. And Russia and China have been doing it. And India has been doing it. If you thought this is all behind, and you think these were backwards countries, you think this was emerging nations like they had nothing, like there was something behind trying to catch up. Why are they all equal in this? They're common in what they do as well. And here's the evidence. Climate change is not about the weather. Some more. The IMF World Bank introduced a new taxation to its borrowers. The eco levy is a tax placed on the movement of controlling waste management and saving the environment. The levy covers products such as diapers, sanitary pads, and a majority of the packaging material, tires, mobile phones, and even televisions. The article reads, the title, KAM raises concerns with IMF on eco-levy excise duty. The Kenyan Association of Manufacturers, KAM, has opposed eco-levy and a new environmental tax targeting manufacturers and importers of selected 18 products under the proposed Finance Bill 2024. The levy will affect various products, including plastic packaging, car batteries, diapers, sanitary towels, and rubber tires, and bread, to name one of the numerous necessities the IMF is requiring pursuant to its sustainable development carbon tax demands on the lives of all Kenyans. This is the confessions of an economic hitman in progress, it sounds to me. Note, though, they did pull back the tax on the bread. But you see how they get it in? but it comes from the IMF. This is not coming from the UN. This is not coming from the climate change. This is not the goals. This is coming from the IMF, the world bankers. The global financial system I keep talking about that sits there to destroy people's lives through this kind of a thing. And the people understandably now rioted. Kenya police declared zero tolerance on violent protests. If you don't like your servitude, your extortions of every kind, see, they're getting all their civil rights in Kenya too, folks. You in America, you think you got it all locked up? Go read Title 42, Section 1981. They have the same rights. Taxes. And the United Nations is coming right in on that and saying, yeah, it's taxes. That's what you got to pay. You're the problem. We have to mitigate you. If you go look what taxes are for, you'll see that's exactly that almost the definition. But you protest and the cops will be out to tell you what. The Eastern African nation experienced widespread unrest once again on Tuesday as demonstrators called for the president's resignation. President Ruto announced last week that he would withdraw the legislation, but protesters are concerned that he will reconsider and sign it. On Sunday, Ruto stated that dropping the bill has set the country back 2 years and will force Nairobi to borrow $7.6 billion to fund the government. From whom, folks? No escape from the economic hit woman, either, I suspect now. So call out the police and blame the victims of Ruto's sustainable tyranny, something it is said promised to eliminate when he campaigned. And clearly, they get in office and they flip. You know, they're just a stalking horse themselves, actually. They put on costumes. No one seems to want to understand that. Kenya's Directorate of Criminal Investigations announced on Tuesday that it had arrested 204 suspects in Nairobi and its environs, 35 in the coastal region, 18 in Nyanza, and then several others in the Rift Valley and eastern regions. Sounds like the people and extremists in Germany, doesn't it? You don't like the way the regime goes? They come in and stop you. They take away your guns. They beat you up. They ridicule you. The DCI here in Kenya stated that it is determined to stop criminals aimed to terrorize the public and harm Kenya, as organizers reportedly plan to repeat their anarchic chaos and cruel plunder again on Thursday and Sunday. But let's look again at the excuse to kill Kenyans for objecting to the debt slavery, behavior control, and the curtailment of the necessity of life and austerity, because they want people dead and to profit by their slow and long suffering. And as a quick aside on this, attacking the victims of a manufactured economic hardship has just been declared illegal here in America. As I was mentioning last week, is evidence in the recent Supreme Court decision criminalizing homelessness. The least economically capable among us being declared criminals. This is people with jobs and can't make it. The environment gets more protection. It's the climate is the motto of Grants Pass, where this was started. It gets more protection. I don't think people appreciate if the government can attack the least of us at the bottom, making them criminal. The shackles coming from above in the form here of like the blockchain to enslave them under the same premise. If you don't have behaved correctly, you'll be presumed a criminal if we watch this transformation going on. Then you'll hear, and it's gone. As I ask, what's in your wallet, folks? No, now. What's in your token citizen digital warden-controlled homeless wallet? Remember, in the Siberian Gulag, you have no property and like it. Or else. Recognizing no property, you are already without a home, right now. All this stuff is an illusion at some point as well. The only home you are allowed is a tax home. That's your home. That's what people don't realize this. You call it your home. It's a tax home. The government only looks through its one eye. It's all jaundiced one eye. It deals in tax homes. That's what your home is considered. That's the address you give. When you give to the government your tax form, you're calling your place a tax home. Just like you're doing this already. If you hadn't thought about it or studied enough, that's the source of your civil rights is your tax home. back to the government police state here, declaring people victims, criminals here, while the government and its foreign cohorts commit the crimes. In Kenya, the DCI, the government, stated that it is determined to stop criminals aiming to terrorize the public and harm Kenya, as organizers reportedly plan to repeat their anarchic chaos and cruel plunder again. Could be said of the change agent Ruto and the government itself, couldn't it? And the Directorate of Criminal Investigation should have been turning its attention to the government officials and the IMF, given they are causing the public disorder under a pretense of fraud to commit felony extortion and coercion without lawful warrant under undue influence of the foreigner threatening national security. Additionally, here I would notice sustainable development is extortion and coercion, civil rights equally imposed upon production and commerce that are not supposed to be bound together. It is not interested in development of production, which brings wealth. The very wealth the economic hitman here, or in this case the woman, the Bulgarian Kristalina Georgieva, in this case, seeking to steal the resource wealth in the first place, including the human resource, the human capital, on the Kenyan plantation. And Ruto's all up with it. And just as the homeless in Grants Pass, in the South Oregon and across the country, becomes the newest folks colored by the law, y'all, I'll remind you, I've said, given I have no evidence, though, we live in other than an occupied territory or police state, that if you want to enjoy something you thought was a right, like not being abused by cops, or have the right to witness what they do, or enjoy gold and silver coin as legal tender, etc., you're going to have to go to make it an expressed right through a law or a policy, or you won't have the right. You won't have the condition you think you had, or you won't have the expectation about around all that, no matter how much of a right you thought it to be. In the Grants Pass, the homeless are criminals for acting homeless case is the confirmation of this. Subsequent to the filing of that case, the state enacted some prohibitions against criminalizing the homeless. You'd think people would have been empathetic enough to help the oppressed and essentially defenseless, like the attorney general of that state is duty bound to do so, in black and white. But no law needed to be made here to guide those in government how to act. It should be all you need to know about the state of the state. And we the people. But why I suggest. It's not really just a suggestion. It's a requirement. You're going to have to figure out how to mobilize yourself and make the laws to protect you, make the policies to protect you. Because it doesn't come from the mind and the heart of government, which is heartless and having no mind. It's not even as intelligent as an organoid. It has a sense of what it wants. And it has a big club. And maybe even some bullets. Just as they promote in the city of Grants Pass, promotes it, it's the climate. That's the climate we live in. I just have to say good luck to the true fortune to the people in Kenya, their reflection of most of the world eventually here, that they oust the foreigner debt slaver and its influence and the sustainable change agents oppressing them, and most everywhere, and transparently so. To most. This is episode BTWRLM 585. Those of you who have come in at the top of the hour, we're getting through, and you want to know where to find the links and what I'm talking about, that might help you get to the broadcaster with that number. Put in Real Liberty Media and that number, and you probably get close. You might get us to the website, reallibertymedia.com. You'll be able to follow through as I talk about this. Read it for yourself and get those articles. I barely touch the surface on this stuff. Really engage what you're thinking. You got to understand some foundation. You do have to understand some of the black and white, the principles, the rules by which we should live. The older ones would help if just normal people would work them. And then we read the notice, call it a news. Or as in America here with this nonsense we see in Kenya going on, beaten down, dealing with the IMF, the World Bank, all this transparency that's going on about all that. this continues in America until that they get caught. And we can see this. The bankers, the world of economy, the system that will be in place that parasitically feeds on people. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and seven mega banks paying $46 million over alleged conspiracy to rig trillion-dollar derivatives market. It wasn't bad enough in 2009. Everything was toxic debt, and they monetized and then insured it, and they got more money from all that. No, they're gonna rig that market on top of it all. They'll never get enough, is why we also have to limit. Nine of the largest banks in the world are settling a long-running lawsuit that accuses them of conspiring to rig a $465.9 trillion market. Programmable currency comes to the mind here, folks, to digitally manipulate as well in these markets. Derivative markets are fraud, as I've explained over and over. This is what your country is based on now. These are global players. Lawyers representing investors have filed for preliminary approval of a $46 million cash settlement against J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, BNP Paribas, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, Morgan Stanley, NatWest, and UBS to end an eight-year-old antitrust suit. Representing the Public School Teachers Pensions and Retirement Fund of Chicago, the Los Angeles County Employees Retirement Association, and other institutional investors, lawyers say the banks have been conspiring for years to keep the interest rate swap market inefficient and antiquated in order to extract as much as possible in fees. Interest rate swaps allow two parties to trade interest cash flows for a given period of time. The plaintiffs say that the interest rate swap market is clearly ready for fast, efficient trading on electronic exchanges, but that the defendant banks have gone out of their way to make sure it only exists in an antiquated over-the-counter market that they dominate. Let me interject. Doesn't fast and efficient electronic exchanges talk right to the blockchain? And right now they're readjusting who's going to be dominating that field, and it certainly is not going to be you. Here, back to the story. By blocking the entry of the exchanges into the IRS market, the dealer defendants' dealers force investors to trade with them in an opaque and inefficient over-the-counter market, which allows the dealer defendants to extract billions of dollars in higher fees and costs year after year from the class members in the case. The dealer defendants maintained this profit center by conspiring to squash every potential market entrant that threatened to bring competition and transparency to the buy side in the IRS market, like Germany, doesn't it? The people now become extremists because they don't like the regime. Well, since at least 2007, was that right before when, folks, as detailed in the complaint, the dealer defendants have jointly threatened to boycott, coerced, and otherwise eliminated any entity or practice that had not had the potential to bring exchange trading to investors in the IRS market. According to lawyers, ironically, the banks have been using electronic exchange-like platforms to trade the instruments themselves, but have barred investors and the public from using it. So they're already in this electronic transferring. They're getting used to how this works, and then they keep you from it. This also is a programming issue. They keep it, they make it like it's a secret, like you can't have it, so then you want it. What they're doing is they're setting this blockchain up for people. I want that. I want what you've got. And it's a trap. By keeping the IRS market inefficient and within their control, the plaintiffs say the defendants' banks have raked in tremendous profits over the years. If approved by the U.S. Judge Paul Otkin, each bank will settle the litigation for $64 million, though all the banks have denied wrongdoing. $465.5 trillion market. How can people pretend there is a $465.9 trillion derivative market unless by fraud, manipulated, and engaged with by fictions in the first place? But it all starts from the beginning. The debt system can have no actual value. Just the con artist's promotion to get others to believe there is value, perceive legitimacy again. Talk about voting with your dollars. This is it, the perception of value. And as we see, they do. But there is no spoon in all this. The people may be about to find out here, I suspect, that having no spoon means eating no food or having no more than natural austerity provides. But I could be wrong. The imagination is a powerful thing, and people may just continue to imagine both out of thin air, as long as the they are there to feed them dung and call it chocolate. More dung than they call sweet chocolate, the Bar Association run judiciaries. Australian judge who dismissed a COVID vaccine lawsuit concealed she had been paid by Pfizer. A judge allegedly failed to disclose her links to Pfizer in a case that would have scuttled its COVID vaccines in Australia, raising serious questions about our justice system, writes Rocco Loingcano. Drug giant Pfizer is facing lawsuits in several countries over allegations of false claims about the effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines and concealing its risks. In a lawsuit filed last week against the company by Attorney General for the American state of Kansas, Toto, it is alleged that Pfizer concealed evidence that the shot was linked to pregnancy complications, including miscarriage, as well as myocarditis and pericarditis. These last two conditions are now recognized adverse reactions by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, who said they were safe and effective, notwithstanding what they could have heard behind the woodshed for 4 years, 5 years. The lawsuit also alleges that Pfizer misled the public by stating that the jab, better definition because they're not vaccines, would prevent not only illness, but transmission. PACT defines a vaccine. When it can't do that, it's not a vaccine, right there. In fact, Pfizer executive Janine Small admitted to an EU parliamentary inquiry in October 2022 that Pfizer never tested the COVID jab in relation to preventing the transmission. When the FDA approved the Pfizer vaccine for use in December 2020, it admitted there was no, quote, evidence that the vaccine prevented transmission of SARS-CoV-2 from person to person. Irrespective of the merits of the case as stated in the complaint, quote, a reasonable observer could and can conclude that Justice Roffe, not disclosing the prior and significant relationship with Pfizer and close working relationships and familial ties, parenthetically, with pharmaceutical industry, this created and creates a perception of her honor intended to conceal her prior relationship with Pfizer and ostensibly from the applicant in the case, Dr. Fidge. The complaint is being supported in the parliament by Senators Malcolm Roberts, Gerald Rennick, and Ralph Babbitt, Alex Antic, and Russell Broadbent, MP. This matter is not as much about COVID as it is about the principle of judicial integrity. I almost laughed and spit my coffee out on that, even if I wasn't drinking coffee at the time. While Sky News does not suggest that Justice Roffe's previous relationship with Pfizer influenced her honor's decision-making to maintain public confidence in the courts and in the fundamental principle of the separation of powers, judges are duty-bound to disclose not only potential conflicts, but also perceived conflicts. Not a perception going on here, right? So, we're failed. I don't even know, again, I almost choked here. We're justice. Judicial integrity. Justice must be imparted without fear or favor. In the words of the great English jurist Lord Denning, justice must be rooted in confidence, and confidence is destroyed when right-minded people go away thinking the judge was biased. Is this special race of lawyers so dumb that they needed one of their own kind to tell them that? Then not listen, so we must suffer this story told to us today? Well, yes, they are. And we are too. To let the special race continue to occupy our countries under the pretense and artifice of doing us a benefit, that we deserve the injustice the usurpacious occupiers commits against us, I guess, if we let it continue, don't we? Remember the standard here, the high bar was always to clear the appearance of impropriety. The appearance of impropriety. It's not doing the impropriety. It's not even getting close. Somewhere long ago, the bar fell from that standard into the pit. And we the people keep imagining it isn't falling. And the occupier is happy you continue to believe that. Because, and to their profit over your life, wondering, how long will you go now that we have your life in limbo? That's for us to decide, folks. And the killer carbon tax cancer contagion is quickly spreading. That's your civil rights, folks. Taxation. On a global scale. Major EU airline introduces hefty environmental charge. Lufthansa has added a surcharge of up to 72 euro for a plane ticket to comply with regulations. According to the company statement issued this week, the levy will be applied to all tickets issued by June 26th and for departures starting from January 1st of 2025 onwards. Quote, the surcharge is intended to cover part of the steadily rising additional costs due to regulatory environmental requirements, Lufthansa said. Sustainable development, folks. The new EU regulation mandates that fuel suppliers ensure 2% of the fuel at EU airports is SAF by 2025, rising and a 6% by 2030 and 70% by 2050. However, experts have been warning that the measures aimed at making flying less polluting could result in higher costs being passed on to customers, which is where it was planned to go anyway. So which is it? Pollution or greenhouse gases? Are you seeing how these plundering sustainable privateers do this? They're redefining here pollution as a natural atmospheric gases in mineral or elemental material. Remember, if you believe petroleum came from dim bones, then that carbon in the fuel was in the life on the surface of the planet already. These gases are merely being recycled. And we're told recycling is a good thing, right? We're standing on the shoulders of dinosaurs that came before us, as it were. Some of which also flew, passing gas, I'm sure. This gang of sustainable juvenile delinquents won't and can't explain how paying extra for the customer subsidized the UN sustainable brand, biofuel, will somehow stop climate fraud and unnatural economic attack on mankind. And apparently there's no one in the room adult enough to take them behind the woodshed when they can't justify their theft from granny's wallet. Soon to go digital, for more convenient extortions of every kind, and to control your behavior. Because it's for the children, locking you up in the Siberian gulag is to protect the children. EU state introduces porn passports. Spain has moved to crack down on minors accessing online smut. You can untie that knot. Residents, here again, of Spain who wish to access online pornography will soon have to use government-issued phone application with a digital ID code and a limited number of credits. The move comes from after Dale Una Volta, an anti-pornography group campaigning for tighter regulations, released statistics showing the alarming spread of porn among minors. Spanish government spokeswoman Pilar Alegría has called the app, quote, pioneering in Europe, close quote, noting that the EU regulations envision the introduction of such digital passes by 2025. Officially known as Cantera Digital Beta, Digital Wallet Beta, the application will work as a mobile phone wallet. It would first verify the user is 18 or older, using one of the five forms of government-issued ID that issue 30 credits that would be valid for a month. You don't even get rollover stuff here, folks. The app would generate a QR code that will need to be scanned to access an adult website. Each credential can be reused at the same content provider only 10 times, ostensibly to protect user privacy, the Spanish Ministry of Digital Transformation has said. The rules apply to Spanish-based porn providers, but the National Cybersecurity Institute will also keep a list of foreign providers in order to enforce the verification requirement through web browsers. The government is reportedly asking social media platforms and messaging apps for collaboration on the scheme as well. Once the EU law on age verification comes into effect in October 2027, Pasaporte will likely be replaced by the Block's digital identity system known as EIDAS2. Stop me when you haven't heard any of this before. And while it's open season protecting children, excuses to control your adult life, West declares open season on Hungary Orbán for his trip to Russia. Hungary's prime minister embarked upon a spontaneous trip to Russia to meet the president Vladimir Putin on July 5th. However, Viktor Orbán's self-proclaimed peace mission, which had first taken him to Kiev, and then to China, did not go down well with the warmongering West elite. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán is being pilloried for his freelance diplomacy effort after Budapest assumed the rotating presidency of the Council of the EU. Kind of sounds like Germany, doesn't it? And the population being turned to be extremists. Do you see a pattern going on here? NATO elites, with a vested interest in fueling the proxy conflict in Ukraine, claim Orbán, quote, did not represent them. In his talks with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, Russia will continue to be ostracized, asserted U.S. Secretary Antony Blinken, idiot, was quick to say. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg dismissed Orbán's trip as one that, quote, doesn't change the common decisions, close quote, the alliance has made to step up our support to Ukraine. Quote, this was a political mistake to go to Moscow. In 10 years, I have never seen such a severe reaction from 26 other countries to the actions of one country, a yellow card. This is a problem, fumed European Council President Charles Michel. Western media outlets were in sync, running headlines in the same vein. Orbán's trip was described as a striking break from the European Union's collective foreign policy by the Washington Post. The Financial Times ran a story citing sources within the EU bloc's legal services as claiming Orbán's diplomatic mission, quote, contravened the EU's treaties, close quote. Reuters cited an unnamed diplomat as saying skepticism within the bloc about Hungary's presidency was, quote, unfortunately justified, close quote. Numerous reports have speculated as to what sort of backlash Viktor Orbán might face from EU officials. Boycotting the traditional informal ministry meetings during the Hungarian presidency was reportedly suggested in some circles. Furthermore, informal talks are allegedly underway on how to use the EU treaty to, quote, restrict Orbán's room for maneuver during the presidency. Have you ever heard of such a thing, someone advocating peace and gets attacked for the attempt? These people are disgusting and pathetic. Just as defense meets war, peace is substituted similarly. When these psychopaths say Orbán's gathering information from every potential participant is unhelpful for the peace process and for Ukraine, it should be clear that what is going on with these people is a war process and why they oppose peace. They don't intend peace. And you know them when you see them, right? So their actions here in opposition to a peaceful resolve for Russia and the Ukraine suggest the European Union itself is not in a defensive posture. Its existence is apparently to make war on everyone, sustainably. And it seems to me any treaty of which here they're mentioning would be a violation to promote peace in which should be deemed unconscionable and of no force and effect ab initio, as this Hungarian president in the EU should declare it. But sadly, here, such an attack posture matches the native, doesn't it? Which itself was only to be a defensive establishment, strictly defensive, but not much different than in the United States, the way the department is changing its name. It has changed name in the past, the Department of Defense. It was the Department of War. In this age of euphemism, these two-faced organizations must be destroyed, absolutely, before they destroy us. You're watching words being used to destroy people, and peace is not their objective. And these people advocating non-peace as governance policy need to be removed to a small rock outcropping in the South China Sea. That should sufficiently restrict these insufferable warmongering psychopaths' room to maneuver, as they would do to Orban or to the rest of us that prefer peaceful coexistence. And there they can fight themselves daily amongst them for any remaining rock above high tide. Have you ever heard of such a thing, destroying someone for suggesting a peaceful existence? I just can't get my mind wrapped around it. I think there is at least one eternal example here to choose from, meaning these condemning sorts are not just warmongers, they are agents of evil. I wish Orban success in all this, in his endeavor to try to find a peaceful result where none appears possible in light of that evil, and that he prevails against the United States government, fostering and encouraging that evil, the same evil it controls, the hand Muppets they be, the evil it has become, and maybe always was. The United States should not support NATO or Europe because they don't pay their way, as Trump suggests, but because NATO and the EU are evil with evil intent, and the actions such as moving 1 inch east on its way to China perfect. I think we can oblige their desires and on to moving on to China through Russia as we move them to the small rock outcropping in the South China Sea as well. That would solve that too. And they can fight each other there and eventually feed the fishes, leaving the rest of us in a more peaceful environment. The United Nations is so important to say sustainably. Otherwise, if not the fishers, your sons and daughters, wives and husbands, and mothers and fathers, NATO won't rule out further expansion. You're the fodder. The U.S.-led military bloc, read that again. The U.S.-led military bloc has promised to leave an open door for potential new members in Europe. NATO has reaffirmed its open door policy during a summit in Washington to mark the 75th anniversary of the bloc, announcing on Wednesday that it will continue to welcome countries which aspire to join. Let me remind you, it was created to stop the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union stopped existing. It doesn't exist. Join what for what purpose? Quote, the Western Balkans and the Black Sea regions are strategic importance for the alliance, NATO members said in their final declaration. They vowed to help countries in the region counter malign influence, including disinformation, hybrid and cyber threats posed by both state and non-state actors. Remember, they are causing all of that. Problem, reaction, solution. Military industrial complex, banker and investment funds, profits, the people and their property, the fodder. What is going on? In December 2021, Russia proposed that NATO abandon its open-door approach to accepting new members and sign a comprehensive security treaty with Moscow instead. The bloc rejected the proposal, insisting that its open-door principle is non-negotiable. Makes sense if they're attacking Orban, who claims to be on a mission of peace. To me, he looks like he's on a fact-finding mission to figure out whether or not it's possible, and he found out they're pretty far apart. He's on a pretty impossible mission. You'd think he'd get some support for peace. But no, these are warmongers. These are psychopaths. You know how they all got there, how they got in the position, the seats of decision, but they're there. And they're making trouble for everybody. And anybody who speaks out about this to explain the truth contrary to the psychopath's self-absorbed narratives will be hearing more reports about this from from now on, I think, where we hear U.S. journalist Hinkle, who says U.S. has zero free speech issues, may become larger. U.S. journalist and political commentator Jackson Hinkle told Sputnik that blocking of his accounts on YouTube and WhatsApp, as well as Facebook and Instagram, both owned by Meta, banned in Russia for extremism, well, they're getting a lot of mileage out of this word, aren't they, signals that there is a zero free speech in the United States, adding that this could result in larger issues. Quote, yes, they are private companies, but this is all happening at the direct discretion and, you know, with orders of the U.S. State Department, the federal government, which just goes to show you that there is absolutely zero free speech in America, which is about troubling division that I think a lot of people in the West are facing with the elites in their countries that could result in larger issues. The journalist said he was even unable to use marketplaces for selling his products and almost all dating apps. At the same time, Hinkle announced that he would launch a new show in the near future that would be broadcast in Russia and China's social media without specifying the detail. Let me go back to that app. Remember, this is a government app that you went through in order for your porn credits. And so, don't miss that little detail. He was stopped by, apparently he uses dating apps. He couldn't use those. How did they know? What kind of control? They're already back there. But when they control the app, what's your prospects in the future? Hinkle assumed there was zero chance of getting his social media accounts back. The U.S. political commentator also said the major U.S. media ignored the United Nations briefing on a recent Donbas trip of United States rights and political experts. Quote, you may have seen at the UN United Nations events, most of the mainstream media journalists do not even show up. It was supposed to be this big event, and fortunately, we had some Middle Eastern journalists. I think we had some African journalists, Russian journalists, but the mainstream media in the West does not care to report on what's actually happening, despite the fact that we had American eyewitnesses documenting the grave risk that Ukraine is posing, Hinkle said. The Western media would have to admit that they were lying for the past 2 years if they chose to highlight any of the things reflected in the materials published by the U.S. experts after the Donbas trip, he added. And despite Russia telling the foolishness in the EU and NATO that because they've been acting as irresponsible delinquents, either NATO or Ukraine must go. The proclamations that Kiev movements towards membership is irreversible demands a response, the ex-Russian president has said. NATO's declaration that Ukraine's eventual membership of the U.S.-led bloc is irreversible means that either the nation or the alliance, and preferably both, should disappear, the former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has said. A joint statement adopted by the leaders of the NATO states in the summit of Washington, D.C. this week expressed support for Ukraine's, quote, right to choose its own security arrangements and declared that it is an irreversible path to full Euro-Atlantic integration, including NATO membership. Russia has consistently said that Ukraine's accession to NATO would cross a red line. It cited the expansion of the bloc in Europe as one of the key triggers of the current hostilities in Kiev. The conclusion is obvious. We have to do everything to make sure that the irreversible path of Ukraine towards NATO ends with either the disappearance of Ukraine or the disappearance of NATO. Better both. Kiev has signed numerous bilateral agreements with the Western nations in recent months in lieu of guarantees providing for NATO for under the NATO treaty. The most recent pact was finalized by Luxembourg this week. But not so fast, says the European West. Estonia, PM Kallas, being considered for the European External Action Service, the EU's foreign minister recently said. The war in Ukraine and our response to it actually determines also whether NATO is credible or not. So, from that statement, the EU and NATO are tied at the hip in the credibility sack race over the precipice. And NATO tried to move 1 inch east, despite the agreements to the contrary. It's incredible, folks. Uncredible. These people. NATO is not credible, being the Soviet Union doesn't exist, the purpose for its creation, and therefore, by her words, without further proof needed, though it could be sustainably provided, the European Union is not credible. Should tell us everything we need to know about these psychopaths. Back to the shady dealings that we were talking about. Luxembourg signs security deal with Ukraine. Kiev has already sealed similar agreements with several NATO members, including the U.S. and Britain. I have to put a fine point and a bright light on this. Russia is not putting up with this. They just said one or both is going to be disappeared. And I can say you could take that to the bank. Unless the West decide to pull their head out and figure something out, they're ramping it up again. You're being set up to be sent over there. Luxembourg is a small duchy with a population of 670,000 people, which shares borders with France, Germany, and Belgium. It is one of the founding members of NATO. Zelensky and Prime Minister Luke Friedman signed the pact in Washington, D.C., where they were attending a NATO summit. Ukraine has signed some 24 similar bilateral treaties with NATO members since the start of the year, including UK, France, and Germany. The bloc has ruled out membership for Kiev until the conflict with Russia is resolved. In June, the Ukraine signed security agreements with the US and the EU. Luxembourg will support Kiev through the provision of intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance capabilities, including the space domain and cyber electronic capabilities. It also will help train the Ukraine army. Did you know that the tiny duchy is a satellite and space tower? I didn't. Sounds like more that they're in operating wash machines and laundromats than satellites there. So remember, defense means war, and making the substitution war for defense, we can hear more clearly the truth about what's going on. This is a stepping toward war. It doesn't look like they're going to avoid it. Remember the state of the economy. Remember the population control. Remember bringing nations into parity. All this is playing together. NATO preparing for protracted wars, says the Pentagon. And don't forget, they just had that party over there in Washington, D.C. Western war, as they had defense there, Western war spending will remain high for years to come to counter Russia and China, a U.S. official told weapons makers. The U.S. and its allies are planning to continue ramping up war spending, which will ensure long-term demand for weapons. U.S. Deputy War Secretary Colleen Hicks told a gathering of arms manufacturers during a NATO event on Tuesday. Speaking at the NATO Summit War Industry Forum, the officials praised NATO members for boosting their military budget since the initial flare-up, now it's just a flare-up, of the Ukraine conflict in 2014, and particularly after the open hostilities between Ukraine and Russia erupted in 2022. All that makes more sense now, doesn't it? In boosting their military budgets. And what's the big guy's cut? Any big guy. There's nothing defensive about this, especially when there's nothing more than a phantom foe. And we know that because, as the European countries have admitted to not being defensive already, they're not defensively ready for war, let alone to wage the war. If Russia wanted Europe, it likely could just invade and take it. But Russia's not interested in taking it. Europe is not even defensively ready. The evil warmongers that the European Union is and NATO is, they're not ready. And yet they still rattle the saber. Speaking of the level of evil, beyond merely condemning those attempting to initiate peace, the type of evil in action supported by the United States. Israel deliberately destroyed all of Gaza's hospitals with U.S. approval and support. There's not a single functional medical facility left in the enclave, while the direct and indirect death toll could be approaching 200,000 people. While the United States government attempts to lecture the world about its supposed rules-based order, it's aiding, arming, and providing diplomatic cover for Israel's unprecedented assault in Gaza, already collapsed healthcare system. In fact, Israel's attacks, justified by Washington in some cases, have resulted in a territorial being left without a single functional hospital. It was only 2 months into the war in Gaza that no functional hospital was left standing in the north of the territory. 1 month later, there was only 7 out of 12 hospitals in the south Gaza, southern Gaza, that remained partially functional. Today, there is not a single functioning hospital in the entirety of Gaza, with some medics still trying to use the facilities that haven't been destroyed by bombardment or shelter in which to treat patients with limited supplies, often to no avail. For those medical professions who remain, Doctors Without Borders have reported a major health crisis, with some doctors being forced to choose between treating their own family members and other patients. In one horrifying case, Palestinian doctor Hani Beseso was forced to amputate the lower part of his teenage daughter's leg on a kitchen table without anesthetics and using little more than a pair of scissors and gauze. She miraculously survived. Another Palestinian doctor wasn't as lucky. He was forced to watch his son slowly die while amputating his leg without anesthetic. And I think it was Max Blumenthal that first reported on this next report. My research seemed to confirm it. Now it's apparently admitted the Zionists murder their own. Israelis used the Hannibal directive, led to many deaths on October 7th, including Israeli civilians. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the Israeli Defense Forces issued a Hannibal directive that orders the use of force to prevent soldiers being taken into captivity at 3 army facilities infiltrated by Hamas on October 7th. The orders were implemented in buildings where hostages were known to be held. Other orders were given to fire on civilian buildings in open areas. Now, I reported about all this, and I reported about this Hannibal directive, and now it's come out true. The IDF formulated the Hannibal directive during Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon in 1986, after several abductions of IDF soldiers and the subsequent very controversial prisoner exchanges. The directive, which was kept secret and never published, aimed to prevent the capture of Israeli soldiers by enemy forces, even at the cost of their lives. In the 9 months that have passed, IDF has refused to say whether it had employed the directive against civilians who had been taken hostage. It now seems, according to documents and testimonies viewed by Haaretz, that this and other orders were given that led to the deaths of a significant number of 1,222 people, including Jews, Israeli Palestinians, Bedouins, along with foreign nationals that died during October 7th attack. There has been little coverage of Haaretz's report in the mainstream, given its undermining of the Israeli claims that Hamas was responsible for the majority of civilian deaths, the pretext for its genocidal war. The use of Hannibal directive also sheds an unwelcome light on the ethos prevailing in the Israeli military and society, evidenced in the number of video clips posted by soldiers celebrating the shooting of defenseless civilians and destruction of their own towns and cities. And it's been worse. They set up things as bait, wounded people. They would put them out in the street, and when someone came to help, they'd shoot those people too. And they'd shoot to wound, so there'd be more to help. As yet, the number of civilians and soldiers killed by Israeli fire is unknown, in part at least, because there have been no autopsies identifying the cause of death, such as the type of weaponry used. This indicated that there were ferocious armed battles between Israeli military and Palestinians in which the lives of civilians counted very little with the idea. Yasmin Porat, an Israeli woman whose partner was killed and held hostage in Kibbutz Beeri, told how the IDF fired not just on the 40 or so Palestinian invaders in the building, but also the 14 hostages, including 2 children. She described the heavy crossfire as insane. The exposure of Israeli's criminality against its own citizens exposes the U.S. media and political establishment and its European allies, which have fully embraced Israel's claims surrounding the October 7th attack. The revelations further expose the Gaza genocide as criminal conspiracy by the Netanyahu regime and its imperialist backers. So the Zionists used the cannibal directive and blamed Hamas, the Palestinians, and their 18,000 babies, and killed them. There was a report published in the Lancet that the number of killed was not implausibly estimated to be actually 186,000. You heard 200,000 there as well, or higher, given the conservative estimate considering indirect deaths, not the mere 40,000 reported by the media at this point. Granted, this Lancet report is a letter and not a peer-reviewed, but anyone is free to read it and consider what the authors have to say. I can give you a link for that. The authors in the correspondence entitled Counting the Dead in Gaza, Difficult but Essential, explain the total death toll is expected to be large given the intensity of the conflict, destroyed healthcare, infrastructure, severe shortages of food, water, and shelter, population's inability to flee to safe places, and the loss of funding to UNRWA, one of the very few humanitarian organizations still active in the Gaza Strip. I'm going to interject here. Remember, the Zionists claimed WRA had Hamas in it and targeted them as well. And the world, the leaders followed to take the funding away from what is defined here as one of the very few humanitarian organizations that were active there. So the depth of this evil is, well, quite deep. In recent conflicts, such indirect deaths range from 3 to 15 times the number of direct deaths. Applying a conservative estimate of 4 indirect deaths per 1 direct death to the 37,396 deaths reported, it is not implausible to estimate that up to 186,000 or even more deaths could be attributed to the current conflict in Gaza. And that, they add, even if the conflict ends immediately, there will continue to be many indirect deaths in the coming months and years from causes such as reproductive, communicable, and non-communicable diseases. So what we're getting in the news is just a part of it. And I was astonished to see, historically, they were only counting 4, but it could be as high as 15 times the reported deaths. Then they have, as they say here, the problem. We're not finding all the bodies. They're piling up the buildings in rubble heaps that no one can clear. And if you try to clear them, they kill you. So I'm not sure I've ever heard of a count of people outside that they would keep these numbers going. We heard a couple million people were there. And so this is another report, and I have to say it is just a letter. But I went through and looked at it. I looked at some of the reports. I looked at some of the backing, and it looks like it's legitimate. It's a legitimate concern. This is not the diminutive protection, defense that Israel's putting on. What they're saying about wanting to clear the space of Palestinians is what they're attempting to do, and they're trying to make themselves look good at it. And they're killing Jews to do it. Again, the Zionist Federation movement is a political movement. They convinced kings, the king, and the United States government, Crown, UK, to install them in Palestine. And when you read the papers, it looked pretty good. It looked like, okay, we're going to put the Jews down here. We'll reintegrate them to their land, you know, part of their land. And that everything would be fine. But that really wasn't the plan. What was the secret about that? What we're seeing today is they're trying to rush to the exit to fix this. Done. Get it finished. And atrocities are being done, and there's nobody to stop it. They're keeping the perception of legitimacy going. It's one of the themes of the entire broadcast. When you read about occupying forces, what the occupier has to do, he's just got to make it seem that to you that everything's fine. He's got to put enough of a face on everything, a false front, in order to let you believe that what you're living is legitimate. And I did it, my own thought, when I started to realize the depth of this. And it occurred to me, and you don't have to have it obvious. Everyone thinks that it has to be so obvious. The threats can be very inobvious, that you don't even really conceive as threats, that they come in different ways. Like, you don't operate as an official unless you have an attorney that advises you that it's okay. It's one of the ways they control that. And as an official, you'll never stray from what you're told. It's pretty simple control. And up the line, you know, no one has to really know the truth of everything. They just need to, it has to go this way, it has to go this way, it has to go this way. And no one really says, wait a minute, maybe it doesn't. And those people that do become extremists. But it occurred to me, you know, reflecting on America and the occupying force I think we live under. The occupying force can create a civil, if you look, go read about it. They are required in a way to reestablish the civil authority. But it's under the control of the military. And the military district commander. And it's very easy to understand, but the military district commander would say, don't let anybody know, or we're going to kill you. Pretty simple. You'll be a traitor. You'll be hit for national security concerns. And after some time, you don't even have to say that, because everyone just looks at the next guy and does what they're told. That in America, we would not know whether our civil or government, which is supposed to be in power, would have substituted. And I proved that by reading to you or telling you about the Model Business Corporation Act. There was a substitution of the permanent laws of the people. That was one done in almost in our time. Right in front of everyone's face. Okay, silently behind the legislative power, but still done right there where everyone's supposed to pay attention. It showed the example of how that could happen. That you, I understood, you would look out and perceive legitimacy in everything you saw. And no one would know the difference. Is why I'm reading today and repeated and found a court case that agrees to it. That the perception of legitimacy is the target. Is the statement of an occupier. That's one of the first rules. You don't let the native figure it out. You don't let the inhabitants figure out what's going on. You let their perception drive their consent. Your job is to keep that consent coming. It's why I mentioned cognitive warfare. It's why I mentioned the military is all over that. For whatever. It's perception management. And so, talking about voting, I'm talking about looking out in the world, I'm talking about making decisions. You have to look and check your own perceptions. And I've asked you to go to find objective basis, even if it's the occupier's words. If you understand that in context, they're telling you what they're doing. They're telling you they're there, too. How you deal with that, as I've said, it is a completely different kettle of fish, they might say. It's a completely different approach once you see what's going on. Once you give it full force and effect. Not to affect you, necessarily, but how would you address that? It's not such an easy answer. And when I see, well, people might say I'm judgmental. I say ignorance everywhere. And I don't mean just some little ignorant about this or that. I mean deep ignorance. It's not much for me to be able to say, it doesn't look like we're going to do this as the people. And yet I'm hopeful that we will. As I was talking with Gary L., trying to concisely, and maybe I should bring that forward, concisely explain a point. About your status as a national and state citizen and all that. I did that on, 280 characters. And there's understanding of what you're seeing it, but how you address it and whether, if there's any action to take is all important to identify. And when you don't have a full knowledge, you're not going to be able to answer that question. As I explained, the statuses are something that are presumed upon you. If you do not, as I've told everybody here, I haven't said anything different than I've said already on the broadcast, you withhold the evidence of an improper status, fraudulent status imposed upon you. You withhold from the imposer, the accuser, also the power to accuse you. And then, as I've said, if you find a place where you are at, And if it requires evidence to do so, you bring the evidence. Now you've shown that they can't touch you. Not only do they not have jurisdiction and authority, they can't put what there is in their jurisdiction and authority on you. You don't make that a battle. Because if you're not the strongest member power in that, you're going to lose. And so I've advocated differently as I move along. And I think I've been wise to do that because there's a mass ignorance in our society that needs to be addressed. It's a basic understanding of how this place got shifted around and what that means and how we address it. And I don't mean that in a forceful way. I've noticed that it's in a peace. That's why I highlighted the peaceful nature. There's a way to approach it in peace and it can be done, but it takes a lot of people. And it doesn't mean that there won't be strife, but it also means you don't have to take an active part where you're having to decide to go kill somebody. You're trying to take somebody out. You're induced to go take somebody out. It works at that level as well, where you can't even be persuaded into someone else's game, who doesn't consider you much more than fodder anyway. We have people in the world that are evil, evil, evil. Cannibal directive. Yeah, I know it's a fun twist on a word, but I don't think it's falsity here at all. They get you to eat your own. Hope something I said here gets you to think a little bit, rethink what's going on. We've got a whole lot of work to do in ourselves and then to turn it around. By our actions, we can help probably better than telling somebody, because if they don't want to listen, they won't hear you. We have to come to this for our own and by our own. And I just try to offer different ways to look at things, make you think, and maybe cause you to do better. In particular, if it's just something more simple, not this worldly world stuff, but just something, an attack coming in your life and flipping the burden on the accuser in order to create the evidence. You give them no evidence and you deny everything that they're putting as fraud where it's proper. This is BTW RLM 585. I'll be with you next week. Tech tips are nature willing.
It goes cold. The hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, piercing free. Pull up a chair, lean in close. Lessons to learn, dose by dose. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. Next week, heed the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.